Good afternoon. You are tuned to Juno Afternoon here for Wednesday, or Thursday, the 9th of April, the year 2015. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm here for your host, Kevin Crowley. From the Juno and Commissioners Visitors Bureau, will be here with a preview of Saturday's travel fair. Eric and Pam Beeler will be here to highlight their second Friday show at Annie Kale's. We'll talk with Byron Berline, this year's guest artist for the 44th Annual Alaska Folk Festival. And Nancy Nutrini will be here with Arts Up. That Writer's Almanac, Burnout Music, and more today on the Juno Afternoon. Reminder, you can tune in tonight at 7 o'clock for a special program celebrating the life and career of Stan Freberg, who passed away earlier this week. And at 7 o'clock until about 10:30 or 11, live coverage of the 41st Annual Alaska Folk Festival.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arizona's governor has signed a bill to streamline the process for Native Americans to obtain delayed birth certificates. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heiches reports.
A birth certificate is needed in order to vote, get a driver's license or passport, and receive Social Security. But many Native Americans born before 1970 outside of hospitals were never issued one. The state's new policy, which goes into effect in July, requires a tribal enrollment record verifying several birth facts and one additional document, like a medical record, with matching information. Lena Fowler is the Coconino County Supervisor for District 5. She's been working to reform the process for years.
They will be recognized as citizens of the state of Arizona once they obtain their birth certificate with this easier process. But I think that's a huge weight off of people's shoulder.
In the past, 7 documents were necessary to get a delayed birth certificate in Arizona, including a census record, military ID, or marriage license. It proved to be costly and time-consuming, and many applicants gave up trying. The new bill allows tribal members who've been denied a delayed birth certificate in the past to reapply. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
The South Dakota Department of Health is working with several agencies and tribal governments to work on reducing the state's infant mortality rate. Gary Ellenbolt has more.
South Dakota Health Department officials are very happy with lower infant mortality numbers in the state from 2014. New Health Department data shows about 6 deaths per 1,000 live births last year. That number eclipses the previous 20-year lows set in 2007 and 2011. Colleen Witter with the State Health Department says the state is working with South Dakota's First Lady, Linda Dugard, to promote better prenatal care and more complete care once an infant is born. Witter says South Dakota's tribes are part of the plan to lower infant mortality rates on reservations.
We're meeting with our partners to look at a variety of things, particularly looking at tobacco use and what we can do with our partners there. Referrals to our quit line, helping them with training, making sure our families are accessing early prenatal care.
Winter says tobacco use among pregnant women in South Dakota is unchanged from 2013, with about 15% of expectant mothers using some form of tobacco. I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Groups protecting a sacred site on Hawaii Island from development say they'll continue a 24-hour blockade until their demands are met. Years-long protection efforts have taken place, but organizers say momentum has picked up since October to stop the construction of a 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, which already has a number of telescopes. On April 1st, groups began the 24-hour blockade. After demonstrations, which included arrests, Hawaii's governor has announced a temporary halt. Kamahana Kealoha, head facilitator of the group Sacred Mauna Kea, says protectors will stay indefinitely.
Up to 300 people at any one time have been on the Mauna throughout the week, with 300 more coming to bring supplies. I want to stress that this is a multi-ethnic group effort of American and what we consider Hawaii nationals who have decided that putting their lives on the side to come and blockade the construction is more important than anything else that they need to do now.
Protectors say they do not want the telescope built anywhere on their island homelands. Mauna Kea, they say, is a place of creation and a burial site located on the southernmost island in the Hawaiian chain. Protectors say construction like ones before displaced remains and creates threats to the environment. Organizers say the effort is gaining international support, including from indigenous nations. CBS News reports the company has agreed with the governor's request for a timeout. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by the Tribal Telecom and Technology Conference, Weaving Pathways Across the Digital Divide. The annual Tribal Telecom Golf Classic will be held May 4, 2015 at the Isleta Eagle Golf Course. Info at tribaltelecomconference.com. Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau and Caronin FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Kevin Crowley and Kara Tetley from the Juneau Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, for people who don't know what JCVB is, could you educate us, please?
Sure. The Juneau Convention and Visitors Bureau is a destination marketing organization. So, basically, we market Juneau as a destination for travelers to come and visit. And so, we're a membership-fueled organization. So, we have 257 members, businesses throughout Juneau, both direct tourism businesses and associate members as well.
About how many people are coming to Juneau during the course of the summer?
Well, I think the estimates for 2013 were 985,000, and that's about 90% of our visitation, roughly. And I think we get another 100,000 independent travelers or so. These are kind of rough numbers. So just over kind of a million total visitors to Juneau.
Okay, you're also associated with the website.
Yes.
About how many hits do you get on the average?
I think we had, a number of tens of thousands, 40-something thousand views, at least on a monthly basis. So we get a lot of high-quality visitation to our website. People are actively, actively planning and booking trips to Juneau.
And there's lots of things to do in Juneau. If you go to the travel fair, you can find out all you want to know.
Yes, we'll have 27 members present there, and ranging from accommodations to tours and attractions. We even have some folks coming over from Gustavus, and they'll all be there booking tours, actively raffling off free tours and other items and things like that. And giving out information on ways to book and take advantage of, especially for friends and family who are going to be visiting this summer. If you want to find some great quality Alaska things to do, this is the place to go to really start preparing for the onslaught of visitors and friends and family that you'll have this summer.
But the hours of the travel fair.
10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Nugget Mall on Saturday.
Kara, you handle a lot of the volunteers.
Yes. Yeah, I manage the volunteer program. Currently, we have about 120 volunteers. We are always looking for more volunteers to staff our four information sites that we have around Juneau. Two are open year-round, or one is open year-round with volunteers, and then all four are open during May through October.
About how many volunteers do you have?
We have right now about 125, 130. We're always looking for more. Like I said, ideally it would be around 150 to keep things really smooth in the summer, but yeah.
What do volunteers do on an average day?
Well, they greet the visitors. They give them directions. They share information, help people coming off the ships or independent travelers, whether it be looking for a particular item or store or adventure or some hiking trails, so keeping them informed on the information on how to get to those trails and what they're going to experience there. Yeah.
And what are the rewards for being a volunteer?
Well, as most volunteers, it's kind of a, it's just rewarding helping for free, putting yourself out there and making yourself available to answer the questions for the people. And it's a big face of Juneau. For a lot of people, it's the first people they see. That's pretty rewarding. There are some fun perks that are involved with our volunteer program as well, as I like to say. The training itself, which is getting to know a lot of our members, which includes enjoying some of these excursions, and that's kind of considered part of the training. So we encourage our volunteers to get out there and you know, see what all of our members have to offer. And so that can be a lot of fun.
Tell me more about the training, please.
Okay. Well, we do a little bit of information training, of course, and then all our new volunteers work with a more seasoned volunteer so they can get the feel the first year that they do decide to volunteer, figure out, you know, to where they're comfortable answering the questions that come up. And then we offer familiarization tours throughout the year where we try to get local, our members, to invite the volunteers out to their place to experience what they have to offer. So that could be plane rides, helicopter rides, glacier gardens. Different stores will encourage the visitors to come in, or the volunteers to come in as well, and see what they have to do. So we have a lot of really fun training events throughout the spring, and April and May, it's kind of our big time. So
when's the big day for learning all this information?
Well, we have a few different options for people to get involved throughout April. There are a few different training sessions. Our big one that is probably April 27th, and it's called the What's New, which tells everybody, new and old volunteers, the new things happening in Juneau with our members this current season.
All right. Sounds exciting.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
I like visitors because it's just like mom or dad coming to visit.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to add before I might forget to ask?
No, I would encourage folks to you know, take some time, whether it's, you know, before you go down to Folk Fest, or if you're going to take a break midday from 10 to 2 and stop by and check out all the great stuff that's going on the travel fair on Saturday at the Nugget Mall.
Where's the Convention and Visitors Bureau itself?
Our office is on 800 Glacier Avenue, which is right next to across from the federal building, right by Gold Creek, the same building as the Alaska Vision Center.
And the phone number or website for people to contact in?
You can check us out at traveljuneau.com, and our main phone line is 586-2201. And you can call that main line and reach any of us, myself or Kara, anyone else in our office.
All right, thanks so much for coming down.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
In a fit of desperation in 1942, when the rest of the world was off at war, the armies got together on what they had to do, even though it was never done before. They pushed a strip of gravel through the northern wilderness, 1,500 miles of mud, dust, and snow. 8 months after they started, it was finished more or less, but the changes it brought on, they couldn't know. More than just the highway, it symbolizes dreams. For the people who have used it, it is more than what it seems. Through the mountains, bogs, and forests, over rivers, creeks, and streams, the Alaska Highway goes on. Over the years, people have used it, first a trickle, then a flood, in a motley vehicular parade. Trucks and cars of all descriptions driving through the dust and mud. The overland connection, it was made. It's taken headlights by the hundreds and windshields by the score, as migrants left their homes and ventured forth. Hitchhikers, workers, families, truck drivers, tramps, and more reach with their own reasons for heading north. More than just a highway, it symbolizes dreams. For the people who have used it, it is more than what it seems. Through the mountains, bogs, and forests, over rivers, creeks, and streams, the Alaska Highway goes on. Thank you. mostly pavement, and they've straightened out the bends. Some say the adventure's long gone past, that now is showing tendencies of much more modern trends. That's the thing about frontiers, they never last. But it's still a long, long ways when you start from Dawson Creek, and it's still the same huge country all the way. It's still the way to travel if this is Northland that you seek, where so many who come to visit have to stay. More than just the highway, it symbolizes dreams. For the people who have used it, it is more than what it seems. Through the mountains, bogs, and forests, over rivers, creeks, and streams, the Alaska Highway goes on. More than just the highway, it symbolizes dreams. For the people who have used it, it is more than what it seems. Through the mountains, bogs, and forests, over rivers, creeks, and streams, the Alaska Highway goes on.
Will Putman and Shanti Elder. Will will be in town on Sunday at 3 o'clock to join the Alaska Folk Festival. He'll be there on live on the main stage. In the room with me now are Colleen Goldrich and Eric Beeler. Eric, you're doing a second Friday show in the Kales Gallery. Thank you for coming down.
All right, you're welcome.
So most of you know, are familiar with your work as Folk Festival poster design, several of them over the course of the past few years.
Oh, yeah. I think I did 5 years of that poster. Well, I'll go. That was fun.
A lot of detail in your work.
It was the same with the blocks. You're talking about my wood engravings.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd have the block of wood, and I'd put the drawing on there, and then I'm cutting out the wood really fine and then printing those.
Describe your creative process.
Creative process? Well, it's kind of like a lot of people. If it's a sunny day, I'm a lot more creative because the moods affect me. So if I see some inspiration outside, and then make a drawing of that. And then here's the one thing I really love to do with the Folk Festival and all this stuff. I work to music. I have the right instrumental music. My artwork actually works better. It really influences it, like if I'm sitting outside and the birds are singing right or something. But if I get the right tune, I'm really creating fast. But if I'm in a hurry and I'm doing my big color stuff, I put on, you know, a little bit of rock and roll, and I can do things faster. But if I want to slow down, I'll do in the bluegrass, and especially with more traditional stuff, I want to get more acoustic instruments to do my stuff.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there's kind of two sides to your artwork. One is the wild and crazy stuff, and one is more serious.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm doing the serious, like, 1890s, you know, cutting like a dollar bill, really fine stuff that's really intricate that I got to focus on. And then I've got the other side that's, well, it would be like a classical musician. One day he's playing in the orchestra, but then at night he goes out and plays in the clubs and plays jazz or blues. And so that's the side where I hold my hand back and I just throw the colors around. And that is fun for the release.
Your wife Pam is also an artist.
Oh, yeah. She's doing fiber art, where she's doing spinning and weaving, because we do a homestead. We have our own sheep and doing the dyeing and everything. And then she's doing landscapes, kind of like I'm doing with my color, but with fur.
Where do you get your inspiration from?
Nature. I think everything in nature is beautiful. So I just want to promote the beauty in it. And that is what's so fun, especially with the Folk Festival. I love the beauty in the sound, and I'm trying to transfer it into something that you can visually see that maybe will make your eye move around like the sound is.
Cool. Is it difficult having two artists in the house?
It's
been. Watch your answer.
No, actually, right now it's good because we're both doing the landscapes. My wife has been working so hard managing me because, you know, I'm doing my business. And now that she's being more creative with hers, the two of us, we can critique each other. Because actually being an artist all by yourself in the woods, you get pretty depressed. You need that outside influence, like seeing other musicians here, you know, everybody else, and you pick up different styles. And you say, wow, I guess it is okay, because you're always critiquing things and putting it down, you know, thinking this is bad, you know.
And you live kind of off the grid.
Oh, very off the grid.
Near Pelican.
Well, yeah, 4 miles out of Pelican, and we're very remote, have a homestead and grow all our, you know, stuff organic. And
how does that influence your work?
everything. That's why I moved out here, to get away from all these sounds so I can I do a lot of meditating, so getting the energy from the earth, and that's where I was saying with music, with certain music, you get the energy from that music and transfer it into something visual, which is wonderful.
Like a lot of writers, they have to set themselves writing on a certain schedule. Do you have a schedule that you produce your art with?
No, it's just, it can hit me just all of a sudden. Just like after the show, I'll be so happy. I'll go home and I'll just do all this really wild energy, get these ideas out. But mostly in the summer, I'm so busy with my gardens. And, of course, I'm a boat builder, too, and I'm building boats and helping on boats to do stuff. I'd say functional sculptures. That's what boats are. So mostly it's in the winter when I can cut out the rest of the world and use some sketches or photographs I've had from the summertime and then do my work a lot of times.
About what size is your work?
Oh, geez, little tiny. The wood engravings are, you know, a little 3 inches by 5 inches.
Yeah, about that. And some are bigger than that, up to what?
3 foot by 4 foot.
Yeah, his color, of the color work.
Yeah. Some large,
it's like two completely different mediums.
Oh, yeah. The one's little tough cutting of things, it takes you, you know, weeks to cut a little tiny block. And the other one is, they got a crayon, these water-based crayons that Ray Troll turned me onto, which is really great. And I do these big giant drawings on black paper. And if you put on 3D glasses, you go to a whole other dimension kind of stuff. Just releasing. Like your Hawaiian shirt you're wearing.
If you could describe for me the process of working, what kind of tools that you use?
Well, for the wood engravings, it's these little fine carving tools, the kind of same stuff they do dollar bills with. Except instead of cutting on metal, I'm cutting on wood. And that's the, you know, super fine tips. And then, of course, then the color stuff is just crayons. Just the same stuff like Crayola crayons, but water base.
You're opening your work second Friday of this month, which is tomorrow.
Yeah.
What time is it?
The opening reception will be 4:30 till probably 7:30 or so, right in there. We'll stay, pretty much as long as people are coming in. And so within the art of Eric and Pam, we have three different mediums. We've got the fiber art, then the woodblock art, and then this wild color, beautiful landscape too. One woman saw a piece yesterday and described it as like a Jimi Hendrix. So you have to come and see. And we
but
do
they're
have
landscapes,
they're landscapes. They're so cool. And Eric and Pam brought 3D glasses to use while looking at them, because then a whole other thing happens when you check them out. So it's pretty neat.
How do you do 3D work, Eric?
Actually, I was talking with Ray Troll, and he has done some stuff, and I just work on total black. And I bring light into it, and you just separate the colors apart with the black between, and it makes, when you put on the glasses, warm colors come forward, cool colors come back. So it just makes it jump when you do that. I don't intentionally work with 3D glasses on. I just do the artwork, and then when you put it on, it will do that to you.
Does it surprise you when you put them on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It just, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not trying to do it for the gimmick. It just happens to work on black paper, because I love to work from black to white. Like what you do wood engraving, I'm putting light into it, which is a reverse of the most people. You're taking a white piece of paper and drawing a dark line. I'm going the total opposite. So it's just a fun way to approach things.
Colleen, what other artists do you have in the gallery?
Well, right now we have Mercedes Munoz, who had her show last Friday for First Friday, so we're featuring her ceramics in there, and we're having a special tribute as well to her grandmother Ree, and we have Arnie Weimer, we have Sherry McDonald, Brenda Schwartz, Natalie Parenteau, Barbara Lavalle, Yvonne Zerbitz, kind of running around the room in my mind. Byron Birdsall, John Farringer, Constance Baltek, and Pua Manu, Barbara Craver. We've got a lot of great original art in there, as well as prints.
And where are you located?
244 Front Street.
And the hours for the second Friday?
The hours for the second Friday, well, we're open 10 to 6 tomorrow. Well, actually, no, we'll be open 10 till like 7:30 or so. The reception itself starts about 4:30 to 7:30. And then Saturday we're open 10 to 5. We'll have it up through the weekend. Sunday we're open 12 to 4.
And people don't have to bring their 3D glasses.
They don't. We have some. They can't take them, but we do have some to see.
All right. Colleen Goldrich and Ken, Eric Beeler, thank you for coming down to the station.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 9th of April, 2015. 150 years ago today, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia to Ulysses S. Grant, which effectively ended the American Civil War. Union troops had driven Lee out of Richmond. They'd blocked his route back to North Carolina. His troops had no more food or supplies. The Union Army was hounding them wherever they went. Men were deserting from Lee's army in growing numbers, and those who stayed seemed doomed. And so Lee said it would be useless and therefore cruel to provoke the further effusion of blood, and I have arranged to meet with General Grant with a view to surrender. They met in Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia, at the home of Wilmer McLean, a meeting lasting about 2.5 hours. Lee arrived first in full dress uniform. Grant came in half an hour later, straight off the road, rumpled, specked with mud. Grant wrote out the terms of surrender and agreed to release all Confederate soldiers currently held prisoner, agreed that all the troops could keep their personal property, including their horses, and he agreed to supply Lee's men with Union rations. The meeting was over at about 4 o'clock, and for all intents and purposes, so was the war, which had cost some 630,000 American lives. It's the birthday of the poet Charles Baudelaire, born in Paris, 1821. It's the birthday of Gregory Pincus, born in Woodbine, New Jersey, 1903, one of the inventors of the birth control pill, which was approved for human contraception in 1960. It was on this day in 1859 Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, got his steamboat pilot's license, fulfilling his childhood dream. He was 23 years old, and he piloted steamboats for 2 more years, found steady work, and made between $150 and $250 a month. And it's the birthday of Hugh Hefner, Chicago, 1926, who was writing promotional copy for Esquire magazine when he got the idea for a new magazine, a lifestyle magazine for single men. He financed it with $600 of his own money and $1,000 he got from his mother, and put out the first issue of Playboy out of his kitchen in Hyde Park, Chicago, featuring a nude photograph of Marilyn Monroe, for which he paid $200. The magazine sold out very quickly. Here's a poem for today by Lawrence Ferlinghetti from A Far Rockaway of the Heart, number 64. On the stage set of the Piazza della Rotunda, a couple of thousand citizens, some still in togas, strolling about or sitting at cafe tables, and an old, old flower seller passing among the tables, bending over young couples in jeans as they whisper together and offering them her so dry flowers, and they not deigning to notice the old crone with her gnarled hands and her fingers full of the thin rings of her former lives, each one of them enough to enlighten them as to what love or life might be, and her lips almost at their ears, in which they hear only the very distant roaring of their own futures. A poem by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, number 64, from A Far Rockaway of the Heart, published by New Directions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, throughout the month of April, their Favorite Poem Project Florida invites Floridians to submit their favorite poem. Florida-based listeners can submit their nominations at poetryfoundation.org/favoritepoemflorida. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this station comes from Alaska Canopy Tours, offering canopy and zipline tours. More information at alaskacanopy.com.
The Rolling Stones, and the fiddle player you heard in the background of the Rolling Stones cover the song. It's Byron Berline is in the studio with us now. Byron, thank you very much for coming down.
Oh, our pleasure. Good to be here.
Also joined by two of the band members, Billy and Steve. They're performing tonight at 8 o'clock at the 41st Annual Alaska Folk Festival, and it's such an honor to have you here in Juneau.
Well, it's an honor to be here, too. Thanks very much.
What got you interested in the fiddle?
I grew up in a musical family. My dad was a fiddle player, and my mother played piano, and I had a couple of older brothers and two sisters that were kind of musical and stuff. So I just grew up around the music.
And your father collected fiddles too, didn't he?
He did. He had about 30-some when he passed away. I never got into it till a little bit later, but I'm into it big time now, you might say.
And you moved to Los Angeles in 1969 and started becoming on the A-list of session players.
Yeah, Doug Dillard of the Dillards, you know, I met the Dillards in 1963, actually the same day President Kennedy was killed, November 22nd, 1963. And that's where I met them. It was on a Friday. We had a Friday at 4 show. They called it a folk music show at the campus of the University of Oklahoma. And that's where I met them, and we played together, and they invited me to record with them the next summer in 64. And that's how I got to know Doug, of course, Doug Dillard, the banjo player. He eventually left the Dillard and joined up with Gene Clark, who was a member of the Byrds, who had left the Byrds. So they formed a band, and they called me out to record on their second album in 1969. It was an album called Through the Morning, Through the Night. And it was that was a song that Gene Clark wrote. But anyhow, that's what got me out there, to go out there and record that album with him. I just stayed out there, so... was out there 26 years.
What was it like being a session player? You get to wake up in the morning and find you can't get Rolling Stones at 8 o'clock.
Well, actually, Rolling Stones is one of the first ones I did. I hadn't even moved to L.A. yet. I was getting ready to. I've been out there all the most. Went out there in July of 69 and decided I definitely was going to make a move. So we were back to get our furniture and stuff. So, and that's when they called me and would you come out and play? Graham Parsons was the guy that recommended me to the Rolling Stones. Graham Parsons was a member of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. And so he was a good friend of Keith Richards. So he was trying to talk him into doing more country stuff, the Rolling Stones, that is. And so he persuaded him to get me to play fiddle on that cut.
Do you ever get this funny, like a nervous feeling when you're playing with the greats, or is it just another gig?
Oh, I mean, I always have a little anxious feeling, you know, wherever we play. I mean, it kind of keeps you on a little edge, you might say. I mean, I'm always I have a security blanket with these guys here with me, you know, Steve and Billy and the rest of the guys in the band. We played together so long, it's a comfortable, you know. When I'm playing with other people and stuff, it's a little more anxious, but we know what we're doing, so it helps.
You've been doing this for quite a number of years. How do you keep your performances fresh?
Well, we always continuously try to find new material, and I'm always writing new tunes, and you know, everybody in the band contributes songs to the band, and so it makes it fresh that way. If we just played the same old things over and over, we'd get tired of it. I'd be tired of each other. That's how bands disintegrate. They just don't do anything new.
Tell me more about your band, please.
Well, when I moved to Oklahoma, excuse me, John Hickman was a banjo player that played with me for a long time, and he moved with me. And so we were looking for musicians to play. We didn't know anybody who we could play with, but we ended up meeting, you know, I mean, what musical people meet each other pretty quick, seemed like, you know, even in L.A., all the musicians and all the, you know, great artists, we all got to know each other pretty well. And same way in Oklahoma, I mean, everybody knows all, you find them, you know, you find out who they are. And so when we moved there, ran into Steve and Richard Sharp, one of the first guys. There was a guy named Bob Wood who had a music store who put on a lot of shows and knew all these musicians. So that helped a lot right there. So he introduced us to Steve and Richard. Richard's our bass player. And I thought, well, those guys are pretty good, you know. And so that's how that happened. And Jim Fish, of course, just happened to be living there and got to run onto him. And we had a lot in common, the people that he knew and who he liked to listen to. He was a Clarence White fan, and so he already knew some of the songs I already knew, so that was helpful.
You mentioned music stores. Talk about the double stop fiddle shop.
Yeah, well, I started collecting instruments quite a few years ago, and I knew I couldn't open up a shop in Los Angeles because it's just cost prohibitive to buy a building and get that going. So, but being from Oklahoma, my wife was from Guthrie, which she grew up in that town, and it's a neat little place, not too far from Oklahoma City, 30 miles north of Oklahoma City. And so I told her one day, I said, you know, let's just move back to Oklahoma and open up a fiddle shop and a music hall. She said, I'm ready. So we did that and moved to 20 years ago, actually.
You helped start a bluegrass festival in Oklahoma.
We do. We did. Started that in 1997. It's our 19th year coming up for nothing like the folk festival. You guys have been doing it for 40 years, is that right?
This is the 41st annual.
41st annual, that's amazing. Yeah, like Winfield, Kansas, will be their 44th this year. But anyhow, we started 20 years ago, and it's an international festival. We get groups from all over the world to come in and play bluegrass. And
what kind of role does Oklahoma have in the world of bluegrass these days?
What kind of what?
Role does Oklahoma world?
It's pretty strong, actually. A lot of great young musicians coming on strong, and some good groups. You know, we have Thursdays usually the Oklahoma, you know, the not local bands, but people from Oklahoma play a lot on that day. And we have some really great bands that live there. And, of course, we do bluegrass every other weekend at our music hall in Guthrie. So that kind of keeps it going.
You're playing tonight at 8 o'clock at the Alaska Folk Festival and also Sunday night at 9 o'clock. What can we expect?
Oh, we don't know what to expect. We expect to have a good time. And we always expect that, don't we, guys?
We always expect that. That's right.
Steve, tell me a little bit more about your background.
I've been in music almost all my life. I come from a musical family as well, and we traveled all over the place playing gospel music in every little church from California, from coast to coast, just about. And I met Byron in 1982. I was a recording engineer, and Byron had the band Sundance, and a mutual friend of ours by the name of Kenny Munns, thank you, good friend.
Yeah.
And and that's when Byron and I first met, even though we didn't realize that we had really met, because when right. we didn't really realize that till he moved to Oklahoma and him and I were talking, hey, you know Kenny Munns? I go, yeah, yeah. And next thing we know, we had actually worked together before and didn't know it till 15 years later. But I've been in the recording business and been in this band for 19 years. So,
Billy, how about you?
I've been since I was 10 years old playing music. My father liked music. He started the Oklahoma Bluegrass Club and many years ago, and started playing with us about 10, and was playing with Conway Twitty when I was 12, and just played with all kind of different people from there on. I played in a band called the Bluegrass Review, had Vince Gill in it with us, and went on and did a bunch of albums. Played with Ricky Skaggs and Vince on one called Bluegrass Jam, Billy Perry's Bluegrass Jam. And I've been playing with different bands. I met Steve years ago, I think at that
same session with
Kenny Munns. And now I've later on joined him, and we did a country music show, and I played guitar and banjo. And we did that for a few years together with mainly the same people.
It's the band we have now.
And somehow I always wanted to play with Byron, and I got a chance when Byron called me, and his banjo player wasn't feeling so well and couldn't work, and so I just jumped at it. It was fantastic. We're glad to have him.
Yeah, and being right there in Oklahoma, a lot of good musicians come out of Oklahoma. Like he mentioned, Vince Gill. Vince was in my band for 3 years. After he got out of high school, he came out to California when I was living out there and joined up with a group I had called Sundance. And I always knew he was going to be a big star. Just didn't know how long it would take him to do it, but he made it.
Yeah. You know. You played some with Bill Monroe.
All right, yes. That album I did with the Dillards, which I mentioned, I was invited to the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. And that's where I met Bill Monroe. And we jammed a little bit, and he had me play on his show, actually. And then he asked me right then if I'd join his band when I was available. So I did a couple of years later. Joined him in 1967. Only lasted 7 months with him, but I had a great time. I recorded 3 songs, Sally Gooden, Gold Rush, and Virginia Darlin'.
Do you have any idea what you're going to play tonight or this weekend? Or are you going to make it up on the spot?
We usually make it up on the spot, kind of. We'll do, Friday night we're doing a Western Swing dance, so we'll do a lot of our Western Swing stuff there.
Yeah.
And we'll mix a little of it in probably with our regular show. And we'll do some Beatles songs. We'll do some Bill Monroe songs. We'll do some original fiddle tunes probably, and some good old bluegrass things, and we'll try to play so many different things. I'll bound to like one of them.
Are you now where you want to be musically, or do you see something else coming up in the horizon?
Oh, I'm happy where I'm at. I mean, I get to create music and stuff. Thank Steve here's an engineer, so we record every time we think we need to, so put it down, and we got a lot of stuff laying in the can, and you know, just laying there, who knows what we're going to do with it, but we think it's good enough to release, we'll release it. And I'm happy where I'm at with what I'm doing, you know.
What kind of advice do you have to people who want to pursue a career in music, and any of you can answer this?
Well, be available, yeah. You know, let people know that you're out there. You can't just sit home and expect the phone to ring. You got to get out and play wherever you can. Mingle with all the musicians you think you might want to play with, be around them and go see them, whatever, and let them make sure that you know you can play or sing or write or whatever.
Yeah, it takes talent and networking.
Yeah, and in Byron's case, I've always noticed about him, he's not afraid to stretch out a little bit, and you know, it doesn't have to be just bluegrass or Western swing or whatever. He's not afraid to just jump out there and try something different that's out of the box, and I think that everybody should be available to do that, you know, instead of limiting yourself to one kind of thing.
All right, so. Appreciate you guys coming down today. Byron Berline and the band will be in concert tonight at 8 o'clock at the Alaska Folk Festival, at 8 o'clock, and then Sunday night at 9 o'clock, and dance on Friday night. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, we've been doing some workshops, too. Greg Burgess, our other fiddle player, he and I will be doing a twin fiddle workshop. I'll do a mandolin workshop. And you're going to do a banjo workshop.
It's 12 noon. It's Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And anybody needs to talk to Steve about bluegrass percussion, he can he can tell you.
There won't be many people standing around me probably, but I'll be easy to find.
I appreciate you coming down. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
On down to my house, honey, there ain't nobody home but me. Fetch it on down to my house, baby, I need your company. The tomcat sitting on the railroad track, and he hollered at the mama cat, she answered back. Hey, bring it on down to my house, honey, there ain't nobody home but me. You can break it, you can hang it on the wall, you can throw it at the window and I'll catch it for a fall. Bring it on down to my house, honey, there ain't nobody home but me.
I can't believe they posted these pictures online. That's horrible. We need to do something.
I don't think we should get involved.
Have you seen these? We have to do something.
Maybe you're right.
Can I talk to you?
Every Alaskan has the right to be safe and free from domestic violence and sexual assault.
Together we can make a difference. Visit dps.alaska.gov/cdvsa.
It's about 11 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to June afternoon. Our next guest is Nancy DeChorney. Thank you for coming by, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me. So that group sounds great. What time are they on tonight?
8 o'clock.
All righty. Over at Centennial Hall.
That's right, and dances and workshops continue on through the weekend.
And I think the first dance tonight is over at the Jack, right?
7 o'clock.
Yeah.
No, 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. That's past my bedtime.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
All righty then. And speaking of that, coffee and jam is in the morning at the Jack, all sort of morning and afternoon, and followed by more dancing. It's folk festival time, so there's not much else to do but listen to a lot of music and get out and dance and have a wonderful time. So that's what's going on tonight, and goes through the weekend. We have a few other things that you can be doing. However, on Friday night at 6 p.m., you could learn about bear hunting, for example. That is a fish and game indoor shooting complex on Montana Creek. They'll be doing an introduction to bear hunting, black bear hunting. There is Dan Hobson doing classical guitar live at the Baranoff, in case folk festival music you need a little shift from. From 7 to 9 p.m. theater at Latitude 58 presents L.M. Montgomery's Anne of Green Gables, and that's up at McFeeters Hall. That's on Friday and Saturday, and then again on Sunday at 2. So you have a couple of opportunities for a lovely story I've always enjoyed that particular thing. On Saturday, there's several things going on. There's the Juno Travel Fair at Nugget Mall from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's an opportunity for you to find out all the things that are going to be going on this summer, things you can do with your relatives and in-laws that come to visit, things you can send them, adventures you can send them out on. Usually people are giving things away, so it's fun to stop in there at Nugget Mall and sort of get caught up, get ready for the summer. In addition, let's see, we've got Game Day at the library from 11 to 5. That's at the Mendenhall Public Library. At 12, there's a youth social at Heritage Coffee Cafe by the Sigla Group. And from 12:30 to 1:30, Rally for Public Education on the Capitol steps. As everything is being cut, public education has taken a big hit, and it affects the arts for sure. So it's important that we make people know that where public art and public education is important. From 2 to 4 p.m., Theater at Latitude, as I mentioned. Oh, they're doing a Saturday show, too, at 2 p.m. Broadway on Ice at the Treadwell Ice Arena from 3 to 5 on Saturday, and again from 7 to 9. That's over in Douglas at the Treadwell Arena. We have on Sunday at 11 a.m., in addition to being the last day of Folk Festival, the Rush and Slush 5K. It's out at the Airport Dyke Trail, and this is a fundraiser for some UAS students that are going to, just gone away from my head where they're going, but someplace to do something good for the world. So go out and run on the dike. And I think it is supposed to snow, so have a good time.
According to the forecast, it's numerous rains and snow showers predicted for Sunday night.
Yeah, see? So it is a slush thing. There is international folk dancing from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Downtown Alaska Club. On Monday, there's a Tlingit Language Learners Group in the Downtown Public Library in the large conference room from 6 to 7 p.m. There is at the Canvas, 6:30 to 9 p.m., handmade artist books with Andriana Donahue. So you can sign up for that. That's open to the public. Let's see. We've got the 4th of July committee over in Douglas. They do a great job. And if you'd like to get involved, they have a meeting happening at 6:29 p.m. on Tuesday.
Not 6:30.
Apparently it says 6:29 here. I don't know what happens if you show up at 6:30, but it's at the Douglas Fire Hall in the library meeting room. So get involved. It's the 4th of July here is a lot of fun, and it's a lot of fun because a lot of people get involved in making it happen. So if you're looking for something fun to get involved with, that's one of them. Let's see. We got the Right for Your Life folks meeting out at the Mendenhall Valley Library on Wednesday at 10. There's Toastmasters at noon at the Alaska Office Building. There's a prospective home buyers. If you're thinking about buying a home, there's a course for you at 6 p.m. at Riverbend Apartments on Wednesday. Thursday is next week, and we'll talk about that next week. You know, it's getting to be tax day. Wednesday is tax day, too. I hope you've got your taxes done.
I did. I planned ahead this time for once in my life.
Oh, really? Yeah, so it's a busy day, a week of lots of things to do, mostly circled around at the Folk Festival, but you've got a little theater to go to. You've got some runs. You've got some ice skating. It's going to be a really interesting week, so I hope to see you at something.
Nancy, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
This is Bird Note. When a Carolina wren tips back its head and sings, something remarkable happens. A Carolina wren can sing so loudly that you almost have to shout to be heard over its song. Wrens aren't the only small birds with big voices, but they are the best known for this ability. How can a bird like a Carolina wren, all of 5.5 inches long and weighing only as much as 4 nickels, produce so much sound? The answer lies in the songbird's vocal anatomy. Unlike the human voice, which comes from the larynx way up at the top of the windpipe, a bird's song comes from deep within its body. Birds produce song in a structure called the syrinx, located at the bottom of the windpipe, where the bronchial tubes diverge to the lungs. The syrinx is surrounded by an air sac, and the combination works like a resonating chamber to maintain or amplify sound. Evolution has given birds a far more elaborate sound mechanism than it's given humans. Where we wound up with a flute, songbirds got bagpipes. Bird songs for BirdNote come from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Swing Dogs recorded last year at the 40th Annual Alaska Folk Festival. They'll be performing at 10:15 on Friday at the 41st Annual Alaska Folk Festival at Centennial Hall. Concerts start at 7 o'clock in the evening and 12 o'clock noon at Saturday and Sunday afternoon. It's all free. It's also broadcast on KRNN FM and K360 North Television. It's 360north.org and on the Internet. The forecast for tonight, rain, snow level falling to 1,300 feet later on, low temperatures around 39 degrees. Forecast for Friday, rain in the morning, then rain showers in the afternoon. Friday night, more rain showers. Saturday, rain showers with high temperatures around 44 degrees. Sunday, rain showers with high temperatures again around 44 degrees. June afternoon, Andy Klein will be your host. We'll talk with Robin Waltz about students about tomorrow night's Art Meets Science presentation at UAS. Beth Ingram from Rainforest Yoga will be here to talk about adaptive yoga. We'll talk with Folk Festival guest artist Ava Honey. And Lauren Anderson will be here with an update on activities at the Treadwell Ice Arena. That Writer's Almanac, BirdNote, and more tomorrow on a Juno afternoon.